everyone to this meeting of OICOS and the Political Risk and Investment Society. And we're delighted to have Howard Covington and Raj Thimathoran here. So to introduce our two speakers a little. Howard, after studying natural sciences and maths in Cambridge, he worked in government service, offshore oil contracting and commercial investment banking, among other things. In 2000, he joined the New Star Asset Manager as a director and completely turned the company around. In 2008, however, he returned to his roots and became the first non-academic chairman of the management committee of the Isaac Newton Institute in Cambridge, the Mathematical Sciences Institute, that is. And he has since written the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, and China Dialogue on the issue of climate change. And most recently, he's become a trustee of Planet Earth, Europe's leading not-for-profit environmental law firm. Raj Thimathoran is quoted as a thought leader in the field of long-term sustainable investing by The Guardian. He has worked 15 years in the investment field, firstly for a large pension fund, and then with his own consultancy that provides strategic advisory and mentoring services in investing as if the long-term matters. He's a leading and supporting major organisational change projects at ActionAid, the USS, and AXA Investment Managers. And he's the co-author of a book with a fantastic title, Preventable Surprises, What We Can All Learn from the Gulf of Mexico, but haven't yet. So, look forward to both of them.
Right. So, good late afternoon. It's great to be here. Thank you very much for inviting both of us. Raj and I met in about October, and what we discovered we had in common was that we had both worked in the city and both inside large investment firms, and we were both surprised that none of our former colleagues, as far as we could see, were taking financial climate risk seriously. So this, we're not coming at this from an environmental perspective, if you like. We're coming at it from a straightforward financial perspective and asking, why isn't the city taking climate risk seriously, and how can we maybe change the view the city has on climate risk? So I'm going to talk about our analysis of climate risk. Raj will talk about how things might be changed a bit. So the questions we're going to work our way through are these. Why are investors neglecting climate risks? What should investors do about it if they wanted to? That inevitably gives rise to a collective action problem. So how do you solve the collective action? So when we started trying to figure this out, of course we turned to the literature of the economics of climate change and in particular economic damage functions. And if you haven't read this literature, I heartily recommend it. It's wonderful. This graph is our economic outsiders summary of 20 years economic research on climate damage. Let me just very quickly take you through it. So about 20 years ago, a very eminent economist called Bill Nordhaus did the first research on climate damage. And this was before there were thoughts of a 2-degree limit to warming. And he did what research he could to see what the damage effect of warming of 2.5 degrees would be. So he asked himself, he surveyed the research papers, how much would world gross domestic product be affected by 2 degrees of warming? And he looked at various sectors, he looked at the effect of rising sea levels, on agriculture and so on, added it all up, and came to a number, which was quite a small number, and XX marks the spot. He then drew a gently inclining line from 0 and x to gently. And it was gently inclining, it was a very simple mathematical function. What else could he do? That's what he did. And over the last 20 years, there have been lots of modelling work, lots of integrated assessment models being done to decide policy issues, which at their heart have this gently inclining line. And that's how life was for quite a long time, until in about 2010, some people called Sherwood and Hoover did a wonderful piece of research. They worked out what temperature and humidity the human body could stand before heat stroke set in. When heat stroke or hyperthermia sets in, you die after 3 hours. So what they thought they would do is run a climate model and see how much of the Earth's surface had conditions where you'd get heat stroke as the atmosphere warmed up. The answer was that before you get to 7 degrees, very little of the Earth's surface has those conditions. By the time you get to 7 degrees, you get little locations where you get those conditions. By the time you get to 12 degrees, about half the places where humans live have those conditions once a year. That's kind of interesting. In 2012, Martin Weitzman, another eminent US economist, used that research to make the following argument. Well, by the time you get to 12 degrees, if half the world's population has conditions where they drop dead in 3 hours at least once a year, that's probably going to cause quite a lot of climate damage. So he said, well, I have a data point up here at 12 degrees, 99% damage.
Turn on the microphone.
Do I need
my microphone? Maybe at the back, do you think?
Yeah. Happy. Is that okay at the back?
Yeah, okay.
That's too loud. Is that too loud? Okay. And then he said, Weitzman, okay, 12 degrees, 99% damage. Let's say at 6 degrees, we've got 50% damage. This is 50% of world gross domestic product gone because of warming. And down here, let's link it up to the Nordhaus curve. So let's vary the Nordhaus formula so you get something that goes up like that. Well, okay, why not? I mean, that's a perfectly plausible, sensible way of going about something which is so unknown. And then last year, Simon Dietz and Lord Stern wrote a paper where they looked at various climate models, various damage functions and various economic models, and said, well, you know, what Weitzman did is very interesting, but why wait so long for the damage to rise? We actually know quite a lot, they argued, about what happens at 4 degrees. There's been quite a lot of research by the Potsdam Institute on what a 4-degree world would look like. You get essentially a new climate system. If you look at the distribution of average monthly temperatures in that world, it has shifted 6 standard deviations towards warming. Six standard deviations in a normal distribution is a big shift. So it is a new climate. And the Potsdam Institute had conjectured that in that world you would have cascades of regional failure from all the things you can imagine, crops, floods, damage, and the rest of it. So Dietz and Stern said, let's put 4 degrees at 50% and let's go up to 99% damages at 8 degrees, which is where this heat stroke starts getting serious. So that's a Dietz and Stern damage curve. If Simon Dietz were here, he would say, please tell everybody that this was one of the cases that we considered, and it was the most extreme case, and we're not certain that we would take all our colleagues with us. So I now told you that, and if Simon asks, you can say that. From the point of view of our analysis, that's absolutely fine. What we have been looking for is, if you like, a plausible worst case for what damage might be, and it strikes me that this is a plausible worst case. So, what do we make of that, and how come we have got a collection of eminent economists whose estimate of what climate damage is at temperatures of 4 or 5 degrees can range from the Nordhaus number down here up to the Dietzenstern number up there. Why is that? And you can get to the answer quite quickly. We might get to 4 or 5 degrees warming right at the end of the century, let's suppose, in the worst case. Agriculture by then might be something like 3% of gross world product. Let us just suppose that by the time the world is warmed to 4 or 5 degrees, best practice farming has been rolled out, new genetic technologies have been applied, the net result on crop yields of, let's say, 4 degrees warming is a reduction of a third, shall we say. Well, one could conceivably live with a third, a lot of belt tightening, a lot of greater efficiency in distribution of food and so on. So let's suppose you do live with a third, and what has happened is that the 3% of world gross domestic product that comes from food has dropped to 2%. Perfectly understandable in terms of the Nordhaus damage. Then suppose that you go through a period where you have some quite dramatic fluctuations in growing conditions. You have correlated droughts in the world's major growing regions. Correlated droughts are one of the things that come out of the 4-degree world. And let's suppose that crop yields drop another third. Well, now you've lost 2% of gross world product, but you probably can't cope so well with food production dropping by two-thirds, and all of a sudden you have all sorts of other effects coming in. You can construct just so stories for what you would have, but you would have cascades of failure at regional levels, which suddenly lift you from here in terms of the damage done to the world economy somewhere up here. There was a piece in Nature today, as it happened, a comment piece, which began with the following two sentences, which are highly apposite, so I shall just read it. Globalization is changing the nature of risk. Natural and social systems, from climate to energy, food, water, and economies, are tightly coupled. Abrupt changes on one have a domino effect on others. So what you got in here is dominoes. You've got dominoes in a mathematically complex system. You can't say when the dominoes will fall and which other dominoes they'll knock over. You just know that dominoes might fall. Now, I've called this deep uncertainty, for the simple reason that not only do you not know what these damage curves look like. Nordhaus could be right, Dietzenstern could be right, but you've got no idea of the probability distribution over the space of possible curves. We don't actually know anything about what happens out here because we've got a complex system which we're perturbing very strongly. So what we have to face up to if we want to analyse the financial risk here is we're out of the world of probability distributions. We can't calculate value at risk using expected values in any real sense. Our solution to that is to use a plausible worst case for damage and see what it does. So let's just move on to that. Oh, before we move on to that, the numbers that will interest us are the warming at 3, 4, and 5 degrees, and the damage at 3, 4, and 5 degrees, and you can see the numbers up there. Nordhaus, it's 2%, 4%, 6% of world gross domestic product. Weizmann, 3.9 and 25, and Dietzenstern, 14, 50, 81. You can do the financial analysis in your head immediately. One of the uncertainties in the analysis of climate change is the discount rate to use. Fortunately, in the city, we have no qualms about that. We know what it is, it's 6.5% or 7%. Forget reasons of moral philosophy or policy for having a lower interest rate.
down there, we know what the discount rate is. If you start applying that, I mean, I say that flippantly, but if one's having a dialogue with city firms, you don't wander off a realistic discount rate where realistic is defined by what they use. If you're looking at the effects of Nordhaus-style damage clicking in 70 or 80 years, they are negligible. Climate damage following a Nordhaus curve is very bad for the people suffering it, and from a world development perspective is very bad. But from the point of view of managing a portfolio, which is exposed to this sort of damage in 50 or 60 years, it is negligible. And the same is true of Weizmann damage. It only starts picking up at 4 degrees or 5 degrees. It will have, by the time you've discounted that, it will have some effect on a portfolio, but not very large. Dietz and Stern damage is pretty strong. It will start having material effects. So let's have a look at that. So one of the interesting things that's happened here is, as you can see, we had some nice graphs that they ended up on the machine here with spots all over them in various random places. This is the sort of thing one has to put up with when you perturb a complex system. So I'm going to interpret this random array of words and numbers for you. What we've done here is assume we start off with dividends of one unit in 2015 and grow those dividends at the OECD forecast of global GDP growth. So underlying that is the assumption that we're looking at a portfolio which owns shares which in total represent the world economy, so the dividends are expected to grow at the same rate as the world economy. That's the blue line. Just here, sort of in a random place, there's
what is the
growth rate? The OECD projected growth rate is 3% up to 2050 and 2.5% after that. What we've stuck at the end of the blue line, or what was at the end of the blue line originally, is a thing called terminal value. There's a very simple discounted dividends model which allows you to calculate the present value of future dividends. And if you do that, sitting up here, again using a discount rate of 6.5%, you get a terminal value of 260. That's what your portfolio would be worth in the year 2100. Now, we've now done something reasonably subtle. You'll see along the bottom in red, there are the years running from 2020 to 2100. We have imposed on those years warming. So we've taken a very simple warming schedule, which is 1 degree of additional temperature rise every 20 years. Why have we taken that? Well, the answer is to get to 5 degrees by the end of the century. Do the IPCC models give you such a simple warming schedule? Well, obviously they don't, but that isn't so far out from the sort of worst-case IPCC models. And because we put in this warming schedule, we can now apply the Dietz and Stern damages. So the red line is just the blue line with the Dietz and Stern damages applied to it. Simple as that. There's one additional assumption, which because you're a room full of economists, I will tell you. As well as applying the Dietz and Stern damages, we've also made the assumption that once you get to 50% damages, growth goes out. So we've altered the blue line in that case by removing any further growth after 50% damages. Why have we done that? Well, A, it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do, but B, because Dietz and Stern in their paper modelled the consequence of those damages, and growth does indeed flip over when you get to around 4 degrees or 50% damage. So this is perfectly consistent with the Dietz and Stern paper. Now, what do we make of this diagram? Well, we've calculated the terminal value at the end of the red line, and it's 18. What that tells you is, instead of a terminal value of 260 units, a portfolio that's worth 260, you've got a portfolio that's worth 18. 260 is 15 times 18, you've got 1/15 of the terminal value. In other words, the stock market is a 1/15 of what it would have been if you hadn't got warming, which is a kind of interesting number. Secondly, as you can see, the dividends go up, and then they go flat, and then they come down. There are quite large chunks of the financial system, pensions, for example, that work if dividends go up and get into great trouble if dividends go flat or down. Warming on this kind of schedule may or may not be existential for humans. It's certainly an existential risk for the financial system, or certainly that the pensions part of the financial system. The other rather nice feature of this curve is the red line and the blue line travel together up till 2040 and then only come apart quite slowly. So if you're waiting to see the damage before you do anything, you wait for quite a long time, and of course by the time you get here it's far too late to do anything. It's something we all know from all the 5 minutes to go, all the climate change, God almighty, I might be a bit longer, Raj. You can talk with it. It's something we know from all the climate literature, but here you see it expressed in terms of dividends. Now, very quickly, what we're going to do is we're going to take the present value along those two lines, including the terminal value of the dividends, and compare them. So, this is what we get. We start over here. The dark green line is calculating the present value in 2015, taking the blue line and the red line, calculating the present values, taking the difference and expressing it as a fraction of the blue line. So we're calculating by how much a portfolio without warming is impaired by warming. And the answer is, if you expect warming to go on to 5 degrees, it's 13%. If you do the calculation in 2030 rather than 2015, the answer, which should be sitting up there, is 22%. Now, you can do different calculations. You can say, what happens if you stop warming at 4 degrees or 3 degrees or 2 degrees, so that the red line doesn't come down nearly as much as it did in the previous chart, and you get damages of these. In particular, if you stop warming at 2 degrees and do the calculation, you get damages of 1%. Right now. To state the obvious, 13% is a big number. If you're running a portfolio and you think that 13% of it is contingently impaired, you should do something about it. 13% grows to 22% purely because of the discounting. No other reason. You're just moving 15 years forward in time. But those 15 years are kind of interesting. Let me just show you that, which is Standard & Poor's. Here's somebody giving you an analysis of sovereign risk, the risk on government bonds, as they see it at 2 degrees of warming. And obviously the big message is the big developed economies are broadly okay. That's not a 4-degree analysis, which would look quite different. Let me carry on. I've done the analysis in 2030s because in the 2030s, things will be different. We will know the emissions pathway, probably. We'll know whether things have peaked and are going down or they're still going up. So we'll know whether we're headed to 3 degrees or 4 degrees or 5 degrees with rather more certainty than we have at the moment. We may also know rather more about how the climate is responding to emissions. There's quite a broad range of uncertainty at the moment. It is expected that will be better known by the 2030s. So, and we may also have a clearer sense of climate damage. We'll see what has been going on. It's speculative, but it is possible that the value at risk will start to be reflected in market prices by then. So I'm not calling a climate-related market crash or anything like that, but I am suggesting that you can see how the conditions could arise if emissions don't peak and if damage picks up. You begin to see it in share prices as early as the 2030s. So, almost done with my bit. Why is big climate risk neglected? Well, here are the reasons. The value at risk for a 2-degree warming path is 1%. It's a small number. We don't know where the warming path is going. The damage function is deeply uncertain. Risk reward is asymmetric. You have the fund now, you get to pay for it later. There is intense pressure all throughout the city from peers, clients, the regulators, and legal pressures generally, not to step out of line. Don't stand up and do something different. People will prevent, I mean, the system will prevent you from doing it. The pressures are intense. And even if you do think there's a problem here and you want to do something about the risk, it isn't clear what you should do. We've put the quote at the bottom, while the music plays, you have to keep on dancing. This was the chief executive of Citigroup in 2007, just as it was preparing to go bust in the financial crisis. Now, it's very amusing that he said that, it's very amusing that one's got the quote. But it is what we all want chief executives to do. We want them to keep on dancing. We have built into the system great aversion to standing up and being different and recognising big risk. Okay, right, I'm going to have to go very quickly. So how do we deal with this level of risk? And the answer is we do an energy transition and we get the emissions out of the system. Here's a typical energy transition. There are lots of plans for doing this. The numbers in red at the bottom are the ones to draw your attention to. Annual fossil fuel use currently going up at 1.2% per annum. This square is at the minus sign. It needs to come down at 1.2% per annum. So in any whatever you do to arrange an energy transition, you've got to end up with numbers that do something like that. You can do precisely the same calculations that you did for climate damage to work out the value that an energy transition destroys. I won't talk about it in any detail, but the number is around 5%, because growth is slowed a bit and pushed back as you make early investments in new technology. So you can end up with a diagram that looks like this. So the first line says what happens if you don't do an energy transition. You've got up to 13% of portfolio risk, no transition risk, total 13. What happens if you do a transition? Well, your climate risk, if you end up at 2 degrees, comes down to about 1% of your portfolio value. The transition risk, I've just told you, is 5%, and you can believe me on that. So the total risk is 6%. So by doing a fast energy transition, you can halve your portfolio risk. And the question is, why wouldn't you do it? It's a perfectly obvious thing to do. Well, could you do it? These are the ownership numbers of the quoted companies. Quoted fossil fuel companies produce the fossil fuels responsible for about 25% of emissions. Quoted companies use energy which produces about 30% of emissions. So if you are an investor, all investors in the world together own about 30% of the production, 25 to 30% of the production and use of emissions, of fossil fuels themselves. Here are the investors. The insurers own about 25%, pension funds 40%, sovereign wealth funds 10%, and investment funds 50%, and those numbers don't add up because there's double counting right throughout that. So our point here is that even if vested interests frustrate government action, asset owners could do something for 30% of the problem by telling the companies they own to reduce their emissions. Raj will tell you now how they might do that, but just before he does, this is a completely wrong chart. Fabulous. Okay, I'm going to tell you what those two charts say. If you want to get emissions down, one way of doing this would be to ask a fossil fuel company to present a 2-degree business plan. What would it have to do to to travel on a trajectory consistent with a two-degree world. Well, it's quite interesting to be thinking about that in the context of fossil fuel companies, because their risk in the last year has been increasing dramatically. In fact, longer than the last year. Currently, their capital expenditure on exploration has been going up quite quickly. It's harder to find oil. Their engineering risk has been going up. That has been quite visible. Obviously, their economic risk has changed. The price of oil has gone all over the place, mainly down. Talking about fossil fuels generally, coal now is... There are beginning to be articles that because China wants so desperately to deal with its pollution problems, we are at peak coal, so coal is going down. The divestment movement has created a whole second layer of risk for the fossil fuel companies. It's now not the brand is being rapidly tarnished by the divestment movement, as far as one can see. And somewhere out there in the distance is the thought that one day the externalities, the climate damage, will actually be internalized by someone. And governments out at 2030 or 2040 will presumably ask someone to pay for the climate damage, either by imposing taxes or by encouraging people to bring class actions. So the damages will come home to roost on the fossil fuel companies, perhaps. All of these things amount to a great deal of increased risk for them. It is possible now that, looking forward, their return on new investment is below their cost of capital. So in order to increase value, they should no longer invest. Now that's kind of interesting, because if a fossil fuel company is in a situation where its return is below its cost, and it announces that it's no longer going to try and build up its reserves of fossil fuels, it's going to go into something like runoff, it's just going to operate the fields it's got, its value should go up, and it should have a higher cash flow, which it could then pay in dividends. So we may be at quite an interesting point where doing what is needed to get emissions down actually creates value for the owners of fossil fuel companies, as well as reducing their risk. It's a kind of interesting place to be in. We've suddenly created a very strong economic rationale for reducing climate damage. Raj.
Thank you. So Howard is definitely the brains of our partnership. That either makes me the beauty or the brawn. And I'm going to stick with the brawn at the moment, because my part of the discussion is fossil stewardship. I've worked within the investment system, both on the asset owner side and the buy side, the investment manager side, for 12 years. Doing what's called ESG, responsible investment or sustainable investment. And now I work independently, and that's given me a bit of freedom to kind of look back on what I knew from the inside and reinterpret it in relation to the kind of needs that the system needs to be delivering. And I see a gap. We see a gap, as Howard was saying. Let me summarise the gap. That's basically that the directors of fossil fuel companies are trying, quite legitimately, legally in fact, to maximise shareholder value, to maximise their shareholder share price growth. Investors indeed are actually incentivising them heavily to do that. That's what stock options do. You wouldn't expect stock options not to work. And so what we have a situation is that fossil fuels, which basically account for about 8% of the portfolio, that 8% of portfolio is putting the 92% of the portfolio at risk. Let's just remember that the possible worst case bar is currently already 13%. So you have here a huge inbuilt conflict of interest in the system. It's not that there are bad investment directors or bad pension funds or bad directors of fossil fuel companies. It's just systemically, structurally conflicted. What can we do about that? Well, the key bit of that relates to the fiduciary duty of investors. That's defined in all markets, something like to secure the best realistic long-term return, controlling for risk. It's not just about returns. Risk is a key part. And this is particularly the case for well-diversified investors, people who own a large share of the market. Now, that's getting a fancy term these days. People are calling it universal owners. John Rogers, the former president of the CFA Institute, calls it fiduciary capitalists. But basically, highly diversified investors have a duty to the portfolio as a whole, not just to stock by stock or sector by sector. And the Law Commission in the UK was recently asked by the government in response to John Kay's review, and we'll come back to this if this is of interest, but it actually is much more relevant than just the UK, to look at the fiduciary duty of investors in relation to the long term. And what they concluded, there are certain phrases which came up, but two which I want to highlight, is that investors shouldn't exercise power in a predetermined way. We shouldn't just, for example, vote in the same way that we've always voted. But also, investors should honestly consider the facts and circumstances that are relevant at the time, given what is known or ought to be known. That's quite important, because actually what that means is that neglecting big climate risk could become a breach of fiduciary duty. I'm a cautious kind of guy, so I put in could. Aviva, the institutional investors, a large one, says is. But let's leave that aside, whether it's could or is. It's serious. So what are investors doing about it? Now, we all know about green funds, clean tech, all of that stuff, and it's a really exciting development, and I've been part of it, and I don't mean to knock it, but it's not very much. That is a chart of alternative asset classes, private equity, hedge funds, and you'll see even in that category, SRI and climate bonds, which are the most exciting part of the green portfolio, isn't a big part of what we're talking about. And I'm not showing it relative to equities or bonds because you just wouldn't see them. Disclosure is the kind of standard approach that investors take to a problem. If there's a problem with pay or carbon or whatever, disclose it, and then the market will, as the market does, integrate it into valuations. Well, problem is it's essential but not sufficient. There's a really good project, and I fully back it, so I do not take this as a negative comment, called the Carbon Disclosure Project, now called CDP, which has really forced disclosure of carbon emissions by companies. The only problem is it hasn't reduced the amount of carbon emissions rebased to 2005 when it started. There's been a huge growth in the membership of the CDP project. Disclosure by itself isn't sufficient. This is a bit of a complex slide, and because my co-presenter took so long, it's a rather complex slide which you would really need to go back to Thomson Reuters to look at, because it's very interesting, and it's not the only one, but it's significant, because what it says is that had we begun to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and it's just looking at the global 500 top companies, so that sort of well-run companies in the world, had we started to reduce it in 2010, we would have been able to get away, probably, with a 1.4% reduction, that flat line. But because we haven't actually started to reduce, and in fact, because it's increasing and not due to go down until, say, 2020, we're going to have to decrease by about 3.4%. That's a huge difference in ambition levels. I facilitated a session at a large investor conference in Vienna, it was basically mainstream asset owners, fund managers, and investment consultants at the top level. And I asked a question, actually I asked two questions. I asked one question was, do you believe the World Bank and the IEA that we're heading towards 4 degrees? It was answered anonymously, so people did, I think, say what they said, and roughly about half said they didn't believe it. That's the top of the investment system in Europe. Now, that same group, I asked, if that's the case, how well prepared is your portfolio, your company's portfolio to this? And they were very honest people. They said 84% said badly or very badly prepared. This is in 2015, 10, plus years after we started work on climate issues, I helped launch a project called the Investor Group on Climate Change, which was one of those voluntary projects that we really thought could shape the sector and take the leaders into a space, and then the rest of the sector would follow. It hasn't worked. One of the really interesting things is a survey that was done of ESG professionals, so the people inside investment firms who had the same job that I used to have, and again it was anonymized in order to allow people to be honest about what they know. 53% of ESG professionals say that criticism of investors on climate issues is fair. 40% say it's not hard enough. 98% say investors aren't doing enough to integrate it into the stock price. 94% say that we're not doing enough in the stewardship as active owners. So we're a bit better on stewardship, which I do agree with. We asked a question, which was a disguised question, which was roughly went along the lines of, in 2030, it turns out that investors have had a huge impact on the system and helped really transform us back to a two-degree world against all expectations. What allowed this to happen? And we gave people the choice as to which agents would have triggered that change. The agents which were most powerful were NGOs and media. The agents which were least powerful were the CEOs of those investment firms. And the biggest block, according to respondents, was the short-termism, which is, I think, what we all know, right? I mean, that's what John Kay found. That's what everyone has found. In fact, one of the longest-running debates in the investment industry is the short-termism of the investment industry. That's just a summary slide of the fact that we're not on track to succeed. What gives us hope, and Howard and I had a little bit of fun about this last conclusion, was that it's Carbon Tracker, an independent NGO that's looked at stranded assets. It's 350 Degrees, the campaigning group. It's the Bank of England, with its recent comment about insurance risk to insurance sector. And the Pope, who hasn't yet produced his encyclical, but we have a huge amount of hope for it. It's the religious communities and the religious investors who are doing some really interesting things here. It's not the mainstream. How can we change that? We can change that in a very simple way, and that's called voting. Investors vote, as you probably all know, at AGMs on resolutions. And once, as I was saying earlier, a fiduciary is made aware of a serious risk to that fund, that fiduciary has a duty to act. We know that investment hedging isn't going to deal with big risk. We know that government action hasn't happened and probably isn't going to happen. Okay, Paris is not going to be the failure that Copenhagen was, but that's partly because the ambitions have been brought down. We know that that's the nature of how a system that's corporately captured operates. So what can we do? We can vote. We're calling this forceful stewardship. We could have called it fit-for-purpose stewardship or assertive stewardship or outcome-focused stewardship, but we chose to call it forceful stewardship to differentiate it. I sometimes call what happens today as tummy-tickling engagement. Howard calls it footsie. But you see the difference. It's forceful, and it's clear. It's yes or no. Either you vote or you don't vote. And it's a vote for a constructive, non-prescriptive, value-enhancing action. The resolution, obviously, we haven't kind of done detailed work on. We're still some way from that. But it's essentially to ask businesses, and we mean all businesses, not just fossil fuel companies, media companies, aviation companies, all businesses, to align their business strategy, their core business strategy, with the 2 degrees world. There are other things that go with that: disclosing emissions, reducing emissions, stopping lobbying against government action, which is a really major part. You've seen it in America, you've seen it in Australia, actually reverse policy and reverse a government's fortune. So it's not just the greenhouse gas emissions that are the climate footprint of corporations. As you probably heard if you saw Jeffrey Sachs here last month, when I asked him what the biggest problem was, he actually said it is corporate capture of politics. It's not the greenhouse gas emissions. There are some really good benefits to voting in the way that we're suggesting. The first is, let's be blunt, it protects fiduciaries against litigation risk. They've done what they could do to manage risk in their portfolio. That's not insignificant. It also actually protects fossil fuel directors against those pesky shareholder activists who might kind of get involved with a company on the basis of it trying to do the right thing. It promotes a value-enhancing transformation of a sector which, as Howard kind of alluded to, is actually at risk almost whatever happens. It applies to all companies, so we're not picking on fossil fuel companies. But also, this action triggers a wave of development. You could call it a kind of new Marshall Plan, which would be a safe place, the only safe place for long-term capital today. We really have no safe place to put money at the moment. This could be it. They say that, you know, building is a great outcome of war. We don't need to wait for that to start building. It requires collective action. You know, people don't welcome the call. Investors do not like being called by powerful CEOs, powerful chairmen saying don't do that. But actually, if you have to vote and you have to make it explicit, you just say, sorry, sir, I know you're a potentially very important client for my fund management system, or I'm doing a lot of trading with you in some other way, but this is a transparent vote. I have to vote the way I have to vote. It gives people the permission to do the right thing, basically. And it gets around the collective action problem of the laggards stopping the leaders from acting, which is a really big problem today. The bottom line is that business as usual stewardship hasn't worked, it's not on track to working, and trying to fix the investment system through making it more long-term, making it more conducive to dealing with externalities, doing all the things that we were trying to do, is absolutely right. We need to continue doing it because not everything can be fixed with a vote. But on this issue, at this time, we have, if we believe the International Energy Authority and others, probably a window of 5 or 10 years to act. So that's why we say this is what's needed. We've started working on it. We're really delighted to be here to present our findings. This is the first outing of our presentation, and we'd really like to thank Oikos and the political
risk
organization for hosting this meeting, and we really welcome your questions and having the discussion. Thank you.